down. We call our third case for today, 08AP2458J, Wisconsin Judicial Commission versus the Honorable Michael J. Gabelman. Arguing on behalf of the commission is James Alexander. Mr. Alexander.
Chief Justice, Justices, I am James C. Alexander, and I represent the Wisconsin Judicial Commission. The issue in this case is whether the advertisement, the campaign advertisement in question, contains a false statement of fact intentionally made or made with reckless disregard for the statement's truth or falsity so as to violate SCR 60.063C of the Wisconsin Code of Judicial Conduct. If the advertisement does, then the respondent, Judge Gabelman, who I will refer to as Judge Gabelman because it, at all times material to this incident, he was a circuit court judge, has engaged in misconduct, and we would ask that the court render the appropriate discipline. The advertisement is a false statement of fact purposely made. The false fact asserted in the ad by the language, the juxtaposition of that language, is that Lewis Butler, Judge Gabelman's opponent in the spring election of 2008 for the Wisconsin Supreme Court, did something, that is, Butler did something when he was a lawyer representing a criminal defendant by the name of Reuben Lee Mitchell that permitted Mitchell to commit another sex crime. That fact is demonstrably false. There is no other way to read the advertisement. It is capable of no other reasonable interpretation. The false fact derives from the conflation of four arguably true sentences into one false fact. In fact, the ad says exactly what it was intended to say. It is clear, it is unequivocal, it leaves no room for doubt, and was carefully sculpted to say exactly what it said.
Are we looking at this language from the viewpoint of the speaker and what the speaker's intent was and what the speaker did, or are we looking at it from the listeners?
From the viewpoint of the speaker, the implication was made by Judge Gabelman, who published the advertisement. The ad is the statement, not the individual sentences contained in the advertisement.
You're saying all the sentences make the statement.
All of the statements in the advertisement, all of the sentence and the words in the advertisement must be read together. That is the statement. You cannot take out and disassociate each individual sentence to determine the truth or falsity of this message.
Why can't you do that?
Go ahead.
But why can't you do that? Why can't you, as has been argued by the other side, look at each statement and say, hey, that's true, that's true, that's true, so we've got a true advertisement?
For several reasons, Justice Crooks. First is language is interpreted in a context in which it is made, not in isolation, but as part of a whole. I think it was Learned Hand that said words live a communal existence. To separate each sentence and read them alone, devoid of any context, denudes them of any meaning whatsoever. For example, in the advertisement, which I believe you have before you as Exhibit B, if I'm not mistaken, it says, here's a sentence, the third of the four sentences. Butler found a loophole. Let's take that sentence out, as respondent would ask that you do, and look at it. Butler found a loophole. It's meaningless, especially in the context in which it was made. It's meaningless. Butler found a loophole. Okay, so what? But you put the word in context and add it, for example, to the next sentence. Mitchell went on to molest another child. You take that sentence and take it out and parse it, say, well, is this true? Arguably, yes. Or he did. Demonstrably, he did. Mitchell went on to molest another child. But if you look at it by itself, it is devoid of any meaning. It has no message. It makes no statement.
Well, what... Go ahead.
Just putting those two sentences together does give it context and does make a statement. Butler found a loophole. Mitchell went on to molest another child.
Would your Would your task be easier if it said, because Butler found a loophole, Mitchell went on to molest a child?
Then the advertisement would have literally said it. But false statements of fact can be made by implication. You are not, as Judge Fine so colorfully said, lashed to the mast of literalism when interpreting the statement made in this ad.
Counselor, if I hear you correctly, what you're arguing is not that the individual statements were false, but that it wasn't a complete picture of what happened. Some things were left out that could have been put in the ad, such as Butler found the loophole, which the Supreme Court overruled, and then the client went on to molest another child. So it's leaving out the fact that though he prevailed at the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court overruled him, that really gives what you're telling us as the context. Is that correct?
Although there are many things left out of this advertisement, many things that are admitted that if put in would have made this a true statement of fact, what we are saying is that what is in the advertisement itself, is false as you read it, as you view it.
But I guess I'm trying to understand the nature of the falseness, and if I understand what you said in your briefs and the discussions from many people who have looked at this now, is that there are things that were left out. And just the example I gave you, if that had been in the ad, would you still have proceeded on the ad? In other words, the statement that Butler found a loophole, the Supreme Court overruled the Court of Appeals, where the loophole was used, and then the defendant went on to molest another child. Would you have proceeded on that as being false?
No, because it wouldn't have been a violation of SCR 60.033C.
Why?
Because that code provision only prohibits campaign speech at its extreme. The extreme is false statement of fact intentionally made or made with reckless disregard for the statement's truth or falsity. The hypothetical that you just proposed doesn't violate the code provision. It doesn't fall at the extremes like this case
what
does.
I'm trying to find out is why. In other words, I hear you arguing there were things that were left out, frankly. I mean, that's the context that you set this up in, and that's the context that's argued in the briefs, is that that isn't the, it gave a false impression because it didn't say that the Supreme Court overruled the loophole that he prevailed on at the Court of Appeals. I mean, that's what I hear you saying. Am I not hearing you correctly?
The false statement of fact is that something that Lewis Butler did during the course of his representation of Reuben Lee Mitchell allowed Mitchell to offend again, and that is demonstrably false.
It doesn't say in the ad that his representation of him allowed Mitchell to offend again. It doesn't say that. What it says is Lewis Butler found a loophole and Mitchell went on to assault another child. Okay, so what you're telling me is not the words of the ad, and I'm trying to figure out exactly why the context is troublesome. And I thought it was because things were left out. If it were fully represented what Lewis Butler did in his representation, you would get a different picture than you get when the full representation is not there.
Our position, the commission's position, is this ad is clear and unequivocal. It says, Lewis Butler worked to put criminals on the street.
I understand that's your position. I'm trying to find out why you think it's so clear and unambiguous.
Because of what the ad says. The ad says what the narrator spoke and the transcript of the ad that you see. That's the statement that is false. Louis Butler worked to put criminals on the street like Reuben Lee Mitchell, who raped an 11-year-old girl with learning disabilities. Butler found a loophole. Mitchell went on to molest another child.
Well, I gather you agree with at least the first half of Judge Fine's opinion, dissent, namely
his concurrence.
And what
yes.
he says is, and he relies on Turner versus, among many others, KTRK-TV, which is a Texas case written by the Chief Justice. And that case says, an assertion may convey a substantially false and defamatory impression by either omitting material facts, and that's not the language he relies on. He relies on this language. Create a false impression by suggestively juxtaposing true facts.
Yes.
Is that your position?
Yes.
Mr. Alexander, let me go a little bit further into the language of the code itself.
All right.
It's my understanding from what you told us earlier that you're relying on the first sentence, not the second sentence of 60.063C. Now, the language that I find there talks about shall not knowingly or with reckless disregard for the statement's truth. Goes on from there. What has been presented to support that this statement was either made knowingly or with reckless disregard for the statement's truth?
On the record that you have before you, I think the evidence is clear that the ad was published by Judge Gableman knowingly, with intent. I think that if you look at the record, that you will find that the ad was presented to him by his political advisors claiming that a third-party ad had caused some trouble in their campaign and they needed to respond. Judge Gableman, who then was an experienced circuit court judge, had been a district attorney and had been an attorney for many years, read the Mitchell cases in the Court of Appeals and in the Supreme Court. And he was familiar with the evidentiary ruling that was made in the trial court that was reviewed by the Court of Appeals and by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court's case in the Reuben Lee Mitchell matter, in the first sentence, I think, of the second paragraph, says reversed. It had to be clear to Judge Gableman that Reuben Lee Mitchell was convicted and was to stay in prison. Judge Gableman was familiar with the facts and holdings of those cases, familiar with the issue which became the loophole of the ad. He personally viewed, this is a television campaign ad, a 30-second TV ad. He personally viewed the ad, and he read transcript of it.
Has he admitted those things?
Yes.
In what form? In an affidavit? In a statement?
During the course of the judicial conduct panel proceedings, the panel required each party to submit what they believed to be a statement of undisputed facts, which both parties did. These facts were stipulated to. In essence, and agreed to. There's no dispute about them, and it was on the basis of these statements of fact that the panel made its findings of fact. Judge Gableman delayed release for a week of this television ad. Didn't like its tone. Ultimately, he didn't make any changes. And the ad was published. At the time, as shown by the statement of fact of the commission, and it's undisputed, Judge Gableman did not have any information to lead him to believe or make him believe that Louis Butler had anything to do with the release of Reuben Lee Mitchell from prison, and Louis Butler did nothing for Reuben Lee Mitchell as far as being an attorney is concerned or anything else in the aftermath of the Supreme Court case. Those facts are not disputed.
Why do you think the first sentence rather than the second sentence of the section is applicable? I recognize one says shall and the other says should. The should one is considered aspirational, but why should we look at the first sentence and not the second?
The first sentence, the mandatory sentence, prohibits campaign speech at its extreme. It only prohibits the purposeful falsehood. Campaign speech that is purposely false enjoys no constitutional protection, and the government can regulate it. That is the ruling in New York Times versus Sullivan and in the Garrison case that are cited in the brief. That is the reason, among others, I imagine, that the first sentence is only limited to speech that enjoys no constitutional protection.
Counsel, I'm curious when you use the phrase at its extreme. Extreme compared to what?
Extreme as far as false speech. The extreme as far as any campaign speech. The first sentence and the only mandatory sentence of the code provision only prohibits campaign speech that is false and is purposely made. It does not prohibit false speech. It doesn't prohibit mistakes. It doesn't prohibit hyperbole, idiom, vile speech, any of those things.
A little puffery?
The what?
A little puffery?
No puffery. Doesn't
it's prohibited.
Doesn't prohibit spinning, any of those things. It only prohibits speech that is false and knowingly made, which the courts, specifically New York Times, Sullivan, Garrison, say has no societal value and offers nothing to the expression of thoughts in a democracy.
What I'm hearing you say is each sentence could be true, but together they imply something that's false, right? And that implication is extreme.
That implication is false and was knowingly made. Yes.
Even if the statements themselves are true, taken together, they imply something that's false, and in your view is extreme, as compared to itself versus compared to other ads or compared to other campaigns or compared to other things that people might have said against Justice Gableman, Justice Butler, other justices over the period of time. Extreme compared to itself.
It's extreme because it's false and intentionally made. That's what I intended to say when I said use the word, it's at the extreme.
Thank you.
It's a very narrow portion of campaign speech, and it enjoys no constitutional protection.
Counsel, with the three-judge panel of the Court of Appeals, they looked at our Supreme Court rule, and the majority found that it was it could be in contravention of the second sentence, that is the aspirational sentence of the Supreme Court rule. And the dissent said no, it was violative of the first sentence.
I think it's the concurrence.
Concurrence, thank you. The concurrence said it was violative of the first sentence. The majority said to accept your interpretation would render the second sentence surplusage. How do you respond to that? I think this in some way is a follow-up to Justice Crooks's question of the difference between the two sentences.
The two sentences address two different types of statements, two different types of campaign speech. The first we have discussed in response to Justice Crooks's question, and there's nothing in that first sentence that would require this court or any court to do a sentence-by-sentence reading, or nothing in there that would prohibit this court from looking at this ad in context and finding a false statement made by implication. The first sentence deals with statements that are false. Not only that are false, but that are intentionally made or made with reckless disregard for the statement's truth or falsity. The so-called actual malice standard set forth in New York Times versus Sullivan and Garrison. The second sentence does not deal with false statements of fact. It deals with true statements that mislead. We are contending, as we have said repeatedly, that the advertisement contains a false statement of fact intentionally made. There is nothing misleading about the advertisement.
False, true statements that mislead. Where does inference come in under the first sentence or the second sentence?
What is the difference in the first, second, and...
Where does inference drawn from statements come in? Under the first sentence of the rule or the second sentence?
Second sentence could relate to inference, but we're not talking about inferences here. We're talking about implications. The difference between implications or implying an inference or inferring is... are two different concepts. We're not saying this is false by inference. The statement was not left up to the vagaries of what a listener may hear or think that they hear. This is a statement, false statement, made by implication that was made by the person that published the advertisement. And in his concurring opinion, Judge Fine says, he puts together parts of this ad and said, if that's what the ad was, then it would be misleading because not only would none of the statements in it be false, but what the statement said, none of the sentences be false, but what the statement said would also not be false, and that would be misleading.
Counselor,
not a misrepresentation.
I'd like to shift your focus a little bit because I see your yellow light is on, and we've had a concern raised initially, I think, in the brief of. Or in the opinion from the panel in Judge Fine's decision about the first sentence being violative of the First Amendment. And you would agree that the First Amendment is implicated by the first sentence in the rule, correct?
The first sentence in the rule prohibits speech that enjoys no First Amendment protection and hasn't since 1964.
You don't think the First Amendment is implicated at all by the first...
The first sentence in 60.06 paren 3c, no. It does not prohibit protected speech.
It regulates campaign speech. Why is that not a First Amendment issue?
Right, it's campaign speech, and
right?
Again, it's at the extreme. It regulates campaign speech that is not covered by the First Amendment.
Counselor, just a minute. I understand your view that the sentence doesn't violate the First Amendment, because there's no protection under the First Amendment for a false statement. I understand that. But what I'm asking you is a little bit different. My question is the First Amendment implicated by the campaign speech that is regulated in the first sentence?
Is the First Amendment implicated?
Yes.
I'm sorry, Justice Rogan-Sack,
okay.
I'm confused by you.
The First Amendment applies to campaign speech, correct?
Yes.
Okay, and the first sentence applies to campaign speech, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. Now we're on the same page. Can you tell me what is the compelling state interest and how it's narrowly drawn, which is the standard that you must show in order to uphold the first sentence that you're seeking to use here? That's where I was trying to get to.
First of all, because the first sentence is not constitutionally protected, the court need not go through the strict scrutiny analysis, because that only applies to constitutionally protected speech. This is not. But if it was, to answer your question, if it was, the significant state interest is the protection of the integrity of the judicial system. Campaign statements made in judicial elections that make misrepresentations intentionally to great violence to the public's confidence in the integrity of the entire Wisconsin court system. And as I've cited in my briefs, that interest, the integrity of a state's court system, is a state interest of the highest order. That was just restated in the Caperton case.
Would this first sentence be phrased in our rules any more narrowly and still protect that interest, counsel?
The first sentence is narrowly tailored to only apply to campaign statements that is entitled to no constitutional protection.
But that wasn't the question I asked you. My question was, could the first sentence be tailored more narrowly and still protect the interest that you identified?
The first sentence, Paris, New York Times, Garrison, Chmura, and Weaver, all of them saying this is the only campaign speech that can be governmentally regulated.
We're not communicating. My question is I'm not trying to get under your argument that you've put forth very well.
I apologize.
My question is just a little bit different. My question is, could the first sentence be phrased any more narrowly and still protect the compelling state interest that you've identified?
I do not believe so.
Okay. Thank you.
Let me see if I can understand your argument. You view false speech in a campaign like knowingly made, like obscenity. If it's obscene, you don't go through any testing, right?
Right.
It's just not protected.
Correct.
And you're saying that the First Amendment protects, and there are cases that I think say this, truth. That's the goal. But it can flop over into negligence, et cetera. So if it's false, if it's objectively provable false, it's not protected under the First Amendment.
If it is knowingly made or made with
yes,
reckless disregard.
Your argument also depends, as I hear it, on a lot of cases that involve defamation. That's the New York Times, Gertz, etc. And your definition of what's false also comes from defamation.
Yes.
Statement of torts, words alone, which alone are innocent, may in their context clearly be capable of defamatory meaning. Truth is an absolute defense only when the defamatory meaning conveyed by the word is true. And you keep saying, in the difference between implication and infer, implication meaning that the speaker intended this message.
Yes.
And intended a false message, knowing.
Yes.
That's your position.
Yes.
And that's not protected by the First Amendment at all.
That's our position.
Thank you, counsel. Justice Prosser.
Does the perception of a listener play any role in your analysis?
No. I should restate that. Except that words that are reasonably used to convey meaning, no listener could come to any other conclusion. And so if that's what you mean, yes, there's a person that's communicating a message and someone that's receiving it. But what we're not including in this analysis is the vagaries of what the listener hears. That may be many things, and that's not what we're saying. We're saying that the implication or the false statement made by implication was made by the speaker and made eminently clear by the speaker, leading to the conclusion that Wisconsin families cannot feel safe with Lewis Butler on the Supreme Court.
Thank you. Mr. Alexander, you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Eric McLeod, representing Michael Gableman.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court, my name is Eric McLeod, and it is my privilege to represent Justice Michael Gableman in this matter. Thank you for the opportunity to address the court today. This case involves the application of SCR 60063C to a television advertisement that aired during the 2008 spring election for Supreme Court. However, there are, in fact, more important issues that are implicated in this case. In the present action, the government seeks to punish core political speech, an activity that the United States Supreme Court has consistently held is entitled to the highest level of protection under the First Amendment. As the U.S. Supreme Court stated in Buckley v. Vallejo, quote, the First Amendment has its fullest and most urgent application precisely to the conduct of campaigns for political office, unquote. The court noted in Republican Party of Minnesota against White, quote, debate on the qualifications of candidates is at the core of our electoral process and of the First Amendment freedoms, not at the edges, unquote. And as the court specifically held in White, First Amendment rights are enjoyed by candidates for judicial office just as they are for others. Now, importantly, in Buckley, the court held that the meaning of political speech must be understood objectively according to the actual words used. Political speech cannot be construed according to what a particular hearer believes is implied by those words. And as the court noted in Buckley, a contrary rule would, quote, put the speaker in these circumstances wholly at the mercy of the varied understanding of his hearers and consequently of whatever inference may be drawn as to his intent and meaning, unquote. FEC against Wisconsin Right to Life confirmed that holding in Buckley, stating that the government regulation of political speech must be objective, focusing on the substance of the communication rather than amorphous considerations of intent and effect. So contrary to the commission's position in this case and Mr. Alexander's argument this afternoon, this case squarely implicates First Amendment rights.
Does the First Amendment protect false statements in political speech?
Your Honor,
absolutely false statements.
Objectively false statements?
Absolutely, objectively false statements.
Your Honor, the First Amendment would not protect objectively false statements. That's the crux of the issue in this case, because the commission...
That's why I asked the question.
Thank you. Because the commission's position in this case is squarely at odds with the First Amendment principles that I've just articulated.
Why?
Because the government here, the commission, seeks to punish political speech on grounds that it contains an allegedly false implication. The First Amendment, under Buckley, under Wisconsin Right to Life, prohibits the government from doing so. And just so that it's clear, there's no dispute that the statements contained in the ad are literally and objectively true. The commission has conceded that, and the three-judge panel has included those in its findings of fact, and the commission has stipulated that those should be accepted by this court.
Suppose this ad said, because Lewis Butler found a loophole, Reuben Mitchell went on to commit another rape.
And that's precisely, Your Honor, if I may, that is precisely what the commission would like to include in this ad.
Namely, would that be a false ad?
And just so I understand, if the ad said, because Butler found a loophole...
I added one word.
Mm-hmm. Mitchell went on to molest another child. If that was a single statement made in that ad, that would be the sentence that the commission wants to insert in this case. That's
is
the false statement.
False? Yeah. Is it, then, would it be a violation of the judicial code?
Would it be false?
I asked you that, right.
It is debatable whether that statement would be false or whether it would be merely misleading, because it would...
What's debatable? What's debatable?
It would depend on the facts and circumstances underlying those statements.
Well, was Reuben Mitchell on the street because of anything Lewis Butler did?
No, and that's contained in the findings of fact in this case.
Because Lewis Butler found a loophole, Reuben Mitchell went on to molest a child.
You're right. And
it's a cause and effect.
I understand your question, Your Honor. And that would be a different statement, and it would include words that are not contained in this ad. And accordingly, it would be a false statement.
False statement and not protected by the First Amendment.
Not so long as it's objectively a false statement.
We agree it's objectively false,
correct,
don't we? Don't we agree it's objectively false?
With the insertion of the word because, under, again, we are creating language here at oral argument.
I read your brief carefully, and your brief seems to indicate, in what you call core political speech, which is not defined, your brief, it seems to indicate anything goes, and that the government cannot determine whether it's false or true. I mean, that's what your brief says to me. Is that your position?
Your Honor, that is a determination that Judge Fine made, and our argument has been that the rule at issue in this case would be unconstitutional if applied to the language in this ad. Our primary position in this case, Your Honor, is that the rule does not, by its own terms, apply to the actual language that's contained in the ad. But the question that Your Honor has asked me concerns different words that would be objectively different, literally different than the language that's contained in this ad. And that's fundamentally the difference between our position and the Commission's in this case.
When you look at the ad, we're only talking about the second half of the ad. When you look at that second half of the ad, what does it say in your words or in the words of the person who conveyed these sentences? What does it say?
Your Honor, asking that question is something, frankly, that the First Amendment does not allow the government to do. The statements that are contained in the ad mean what they say. They are objectively true, and there's no dispute about that. But what the Commission wants this court to do is to look behind those statements and ask the very question that Your Honor has asked, namely, what was intended? What was implied? And again, that's not an issue. That's not a question that the First Amendment allows the government to ask and certainly does not allow the government to punish a speaker for.
Do you think that defamation concepts of what's true and false apply here?
I do not, Your Honor. And it's clear that the defamation case law that the Commission has cited is inapplicable. The standards that govern defamation law are designed to determine whether speech is defamatory, not whether speech is true or false. And certainly the defamation cases that the Commission has cited are not cases that fall within the realm of political speech.
It's not defamatory if it's true. So defamatory means false.
Understood. But the defamation cases and the standards that are applied do not involve the government's efforts to punish political speech. They're civil tort actions in which the interest that's at stake is the personal interest to one's reputation. And it is a civil action and a tort action. The standards that apply in that circumstance are different than the standards which the Supreme Court has articulated in Buckley and Wisconsin Right to Life. And there's a critical distinction that we believe the court here must recognize between these two bodies of law.
But you have a court imposing a penalty for defamatory action. The court is the state.
The cause of action is a private one, Your Honor. And again, the First Amendment, as applied in the context of political speech and the government's regulation of political speech, implicates very different standards and different issues.
And what's your authority for that?
Your Honor, Buckley against Vallejo, Wisconsin Right to Life, Republican Party of Minnesota against White.
If you push that, you can never have a judicial a code violation for false speech.
I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor.
Well, when can you ever have a judicial violation for false speech?
Under 6006 3C?
Mm-hmm.
Your Honor, when the when the language that's used in a communication, in an ad, is objectively and literally false. That is the standard. That's the standard that's required under the U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence.
Your position is if you have true statements, they cannot misrepresent the facts.
Your Honor, under the rule here, to answer your question, to misrepresent is to make a false statement mm-hmm. of fact. And if I could go for a moment to the rule itself, and if I may, the court has in front of it, I believe, a copy of the text of SCR 60063C.
Mr. McLeod, before you go there, several times you've talked to us about Buckley versus Vallejo and how much you're relying on Buckley versus Vallejo. And let me tell you what my concern is with that. Buckley versus Vallejo was a case that the U.S. Supreme Court backed away from when they decided to uphold the bulk of the McCain-Feingold legislation. Now, they switched back a bit, to be fair, in Wisconsin Right to Life. But what are we to think of Buckley versus Vallejo and its validity across the board? You've been using quotes from it. How do we know those quotes are valid anymore, given what's gone on with the U.S. Supreme Court itself?
Well, Your Honor, I think it's critical to look to Buckley for a couple of reasons. One, because that is the body of law. That is the U.S. Supreme Court jurisprudence that applies in this case, not defamation case law. But, Justice Kirk, you correctly identified that the Supreme Court returned to Buckley.
To some extent.
True. But ultimately, it's important to note that in Wisconsin Right to Life, but the U.S. Supreme Court reaffirmed the idea that the regulation of political speech by the government, quote, must be objective, focusing on the substance of the communication rather than amorphous considerations of intent and effect. That's the central principle that the U.S. Supreme Court articulated in Wisconsin Right to Life, and that's a reaffirmation of the central principle in Buckley. And consider that language very carefully, because the court has said, do not focus on amorphous considerations of intent and effect. That's Mr. Alexander's and the commission's argument in this case, that there was an intent to communicate some false implication. Now, Mr. Alexander says that an inference is somehow fundamentally different than an implication. I don't understand the difference, and I see that as two sides of the same coin, which is the assertion that there's a false implication means that a listener will infer that false implication, that there's an inference that will be reached by the listener, because it's not based on the objective and literal language that's contained in the ad. But either way, the U.S. Supreme Court in Wisconsin Right to Life has reaffirmed the principle that we do not regulate political speech, the government does not regulate political speech, on the basis of considerations of intent and effect. It must look at that language objectively. We don't look behind the language and see if we can determine if there's a false implication. But if I may, Your Honor, there should be in front of you Exhibit A, which is a handout, and it may be helpful if I...
Counsel?
Yes.
The Deputy Marshal has your handout. Have you seen this, Mr. Alexander? His handout. Do you have any objection to our seeing it? Thank you. If you give us a minute, it will be done.
Thank you, Your Honor. And if I may proceed, Your Honor.
Counsel, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Now, while the First Amendment must clearly guide this court's analysis, there is a narrower issue, the resolution of which allows this court to avoid the constitutional issues that are otherwise implication. The narrower issue in this case is whether SCR 60063C, properly construed, applies to this ad in the first instance. Now, a proper construction, and it's the construction that the judicial conduct panel reached and we have advocated in this case, is that the two provisions in 6006-3C have fundamentally different meanings. And in fact, the arguments that are advocated by the commission in this case, namely that there is a statement that is false by implication, squarely falls within the second portion of the rule. And let me explain why that is. The first sentence, we all agree, applies to false statements of fact. The second applies the aspiration.
Well, it says misrepresent. Is that what you mean by misrepresent?
Misrepresent would be to make a false statement of fact, and I believe that's not in dispute in this case based on the commission's arguments.
Okay.
The second provision states that a candidate for judicial office should not knowingly make representations that, although true, are misleading. Mm-hmm. What the commission advocates in this case is that we construe the first provision, misrepresent, to include statements which are misleading.
Well, is this ad misleading?
The allegations, Your Honor, by the commission are that the ad is misleading. Because a statement that is false by implication is not objectively false. It is misleading. And that's made clear based on the definition of mislead. According to Merriam-Webster.com online dictionaries, the term mislead means, quote, to lead astray, to give a wrong impression, or to lead in a wrong direction or into a mistaken action or belief. That's what the second provision of the rule applies to. It is that the allegations of the commission here are that the advertisement leads to a false impression or a mistaken belief. They may dress it up and say, well, what we're really arguing is that this is a false statement. But they concede that each statement that's made in the ad is objectively true. And they have alleged throughout this case, including in paragraph 11 of their complaint, that the case is based on a false statement by implication. The rule itself does not apply. The mandatory provision of the rule does not apply to the allegations that are made by the commission in this case. This is similar to a motion to dismiss, which is, even if we assume that the allegations that the commission have made are true, they have failed to state a claim for which relief may be granted under the first provision. And that's the conclusion that the judicial conduct panel reached and the reason why they recommended to this court that this case be dismissed as a matter of law. We believe the court should adopt that recommendation.
Excuse me.
Is that second sentence misleading? If you take, rather, the ad and apply it to the second sentence, would that be considered misleading under the second sentence?
Would the ad be
second sentence?
I'm sorry, the second sentence of 60.063C.
And I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't understand the question. Would the ad be misleading under the second sentence?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Your Honor, we don't concede that the ad is misleading in any respect. What I'm saying is that the commission's allegations in this case amount to a claim that this ad is misleading, that it falls within the second sentence of the rule.
I noted in Judge Deininger's concurring opinion, in footnote 1, he quoted your co-counsel as saying that, well, it says this, quote, I mean, this is a classic example. Once you recognize that these are, of course, true, a classic example of what would fall under the second sentence, and that is you would have three or four truthful statements that are misleading because of a key fact that is omitted from the advertisement. Did Judge Deininger not get that correct?
Well, Your Honor, I don't recall the specific quote that was made in oral argument before the three-judge panel, and I hear what you've said. I think the position we take in this case is not that the ad is misleading, that the allegations that the commission have made in this case are that the ad is misleading.
Yeah, he says in his first paragraph of his opinion, and to be fair, he says, Justice Gableman's counsel virtually conceded at oral argument, and then in the footnote he quoted just what I read, but that's not a concession that you're making here.
It's not. And if Judge Fine's view or characterization was that he virtually conceded, let me clarify by saying, no, we do not concede that it is misleading.
What about the first sentence of 60.063C? Is it your position that that is facially unconstitutional?
We do not argue that it's facially unconstitutional, Your Honor. If in fact the rule, the first provision of the rule were construed so as to apply to the ad at issue in this case, it would be unconstitutional because it is not narrowly tailored to address just objectively false facts.
But you agree, don't you, that the First Amendment does not protect purposefully made false statements?
We do not object to that principle, Your Honor. Objectively false statements, intentionally made or with reckless disregard, are not protected under the First Amendment. We will concede that, and I think there's conflicting authority that would suggest that any government regulation of speech is unconstitutional in the context of campaigns or elections. Mm-hmm. The court need not reach that question in this case, however, Your Honor.
I read Judge Fine's opinion as essentially saying that first sentence of 60.063C is facially unconstitutional, but I didn't read your argument to be the same.
You have read that correctly, Your Honor. That is Judge Fine's conclusion, and we're not advocating that the court reach that question in this case. But I would note, Your Honor, that ultimately Judge Fine's conclusions, and this is what the commission is advocating in this case, the concurrence that Judge Fine issued in this case is heavily dependent upon, and I'm not referring to whether this rule is unconstitutional, I'm referring to whether or not there's been a false statement made in this ad. That Judge Fine's concurrence is largely based upon the idea that there is a false implication that's contained in the ad. And Judge Fine doesn't come right out and say it, but I would note that in Judge Fine's concurrence at the panel's decision at page 24, he notes language, quote, derives significant meaning by implication, unquote. At 27, he says, it is not a true representation to imply through crafty sculpting of words. Judge Fine reached a different conclusion as to the central question that's at issue in this, but he ultimately reached the decision on faulty premises, which is that somehow we can punish speech or determine that it's false in the context of political speech on the basis that it implies some meaning other than what's objectively stated in the
Seems to me that your position is you can string together true statements, and if they're true individually, then it's impossible to have a misrepresentation.
That's true, Your Honor. That's true. The statements that are made in a political communication must be objectively false in order to invoke the first provision of this rule.
Now, Judge Fine says there's only one way to read the ad, the ad's two key statement sentences. Butler found a loophole. Mitchell went on to molest another child. He said there's only one way to read those two, and that is that went on to flows from loophole. Stated another way, the only significance of found a loophole followed by went on to in the two-sentence sequence is that find a loophole permitted Mitchell to commit the later sex crime. It's the only reasonable interpretation, he says, of those sentences. Do you disagree with that?
We disagree wholeheartedly because the idea that there's only one reasonable interpretation of this objectively true language, it in and of itself treads into an area that the First Amendment doesn't allow us to tread into. But it presumes, Your Honor, that a particular viewer of the ad would reach a particular conclusion or draw a particular inference beyond the literal statements of the ad. So it presumes in the first instance that the viewer of this ad would reach any conclusion about its meaning other than what's literally stated by each of the statements in the
ad. I think that he's saying that the speaker is asserting that. So what is another reasonable interpretation of the ad in your opinion?
Your Honor, again, that raises the types of First Amendment problems that are at issue in this case, which is when the government asks, well, what does this mean? The answer to that question is it means what the statements in the ad say. But more importantly, Your Honor, there's a finding of fact that's contained in the record in this case, which the commission has stipulated to as to what the purpose of the advertisement was. And I'll refer to the panel's findings of fact at paragraph 9, which states, quote, the purpose of the advertisement was to compare and contrast the background, qualifications, and experience of Justice Gableman with the background, qualifications, and experience of Justice Butler. That's an agreed-upon purpose of the ad. The meaning of specific sentences within the ad is a separate inquiry which the government shouldn't go into, meaning that the purpose of the ad is not in dispute. What they're trying to find is some false implication hidden at some point in the text of the ad that is not a necessary conclusion to reach.
That's why I read your brief to think that even if it's false, you don't think you think it's covered by the First Amendment because of your constant emphasis on objective truth and that the government can't find objective truth.
Your Honor, the dispute that we have with the commission's argument is that their allegation is that there is a false implication contained in the ad. That's a reference that they have in their complaint, and it's a reference they use throughout the filings in this case. They are not stating there's any objectively false statement made. What they want to do is to look behind the actual text of the ad. And what they want to do, whether it be to write in the word because, as Madam Chief Justice has suggested, or to write in after the reference to a loophole, and Mitchell got out of jail, they would like to insert those words and construe the ad accordingly. The government does not have the authority to include words, to punish a speaker on the basis of what the speaker did not say. That is fundamentally what the commission seeks to do here. And if there's any doubt about that, I would note a critical quote from the U.S. Supreme Court's decision, Wisconsin Right to Life, where they say, quote, where the First Amendment is implicated, the tie goes to the speaker, not the censor. And that's it. I have a Supreme Court site that's at 127 Supreme Court at 2669, but the U.S. Supreme Court has noted, if there's any doubt at all, we side on the side of the First Amendment.
Tie vote is not any doubt at all. Tie vote is equal, not any doubt.
Fair enough, but the quote, I think, speaks for itself, Your Honor, and it emphasizes the critical importance of ensuring that the government, in its regulation of political speech, does not go too far, does not go over the line and chill otherwise constitutionally protected speech. That's fundamentally what the commission seeks to do here.
Mr. McLeod, the court a couple of days ago called the attention of both counsel to the Mikhailovich, I guess that's the way I'd pronounce it anyway, Mikhailovich case. That's a defamation case. Would you dismiss whether or not that case should or should not be considered by this court on the basis that it's a defamation case, or do you find that there's anything there that might be helpful to the court?
Your Honor, it is a defamation case, and it tracks the principles and standards that are articulated in Milkovich, track the standards and principles that are articulated in the other defamation cases which the commission has cited. And so from our perspective, Milkovich doesn't provide any greater illumination on the issues in this case, and we believe are not relevant because the standards that are articulated in that case and the other defamation case apply to a determination of whether or not speech is defamatory, not whether or not the government can regulate or punish speech, political speech, in the context of this case. So we believe the case is not a helpful case to understand the issues that are relevant here. Your
Honor. The thing that I found interesting in regard to the problem we have here today is that the U.S. Supreme Court there is talking about objectively verifiable matters. And to that extent, I thought it might in some way be helpful. But I understand your position to be it's a defamation case. It really doesn't apply.
It does not apply. And again, the standards which allow for a defamation claim to be brought by implication, the standard looks to whether or not we can find a defamatory meaning implied in speech. If we can find that meaning, there's a determination then made whether it's true or false. And if it's false, it gives rise to a claim for defamation. But again, the standards, the implication piece in the defamation standard, goes to a determination as to whether it could be reasonably understood as defamatory. Not false, defamatory. And again, the standards that apply in defamation cases are fundamentally different insofar as one gets to a jury for a determination of whether speech is defamatory based on what a reasonable person could understand the message to convey, that they would reasonably believe that there's a defamatory message conveyed. In political speech, it's a much stricter standard, as I've articulated earlier on.
It's also in political speech what the speaker is saying, not what the hearer hears, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And an important point to keep in mind as well is that when we're talking about intent, either knowing or with reckless disregard, we are looking to what the intent of the speaker is. And what the commission's argument here is not that Justice Gableman in this case knowingly made the statements that he made, which we stipulate he did, but that he knowingly made an implication, that he knowingly made some statement that he didn't make. Again, writing in language to the ad and saying, this is what the speaker knowingly made. Language that's not there in the ad. There's a fundamental problem with regulating or punishing political speech on the basis of language that is not stated.
Counsel, the Racine Journal Times recently had a interesting hypothetical, and it noted, it said, assume, if you will, there is a campaign ad with grainy film and the pictures of furtive-looking criminals. And then it reflected that Justice Gableman in his earlier years worked as a law clerk for Justice Brooks. And that the ad said, Gableman works for crooks. With that grainy ad and these pictures of horrible, molesting-looking, furtive fellas. Would that hypothetical advertisement be a violation of 60.063C?
Absolutely not. It would contain objectively true statements, Your Honor.
We should emphasize that my picture was not part of that.
It wasn't in that grainy ad. Very record reflect.
Okay.
Understood, and if I may, and I see my time is up, and
I'm
happy to sit down unless the court would allow me to briefly conclude.
I have a question, then you can briefly answer. Defamation cases involve political speech.
Do they involve political
yes.
speech? I suppose that in certain instances they could.
Sure.
But ultimately, Your Honor, the interest at stake is a reputational interest by the person that is alleged to be harmed.
If I may, Chief, your response was definitely not. But I want to know why definitely not, because I think that any listener to that ad would take that statement to mean he works for
bad guys.
Bad crooks. Not good crooks. Bad crooks.
But
that's
Are you referring to a defamation? I just want to know if you're asking him a defamation of
campaign.
Of a public official question or a defamation of Joe Schmo on the street. That's different.
I asked him, is the hypothetical advertisement a violation of SCR 60.063C, as I posed it? And you said, definitely not. And my response is, seems to me like anyone seeing that would think that it communicated that Justice Gableman worked for criminal crooks.
Well,
and that would not be true. That would be false.
Your Honor, the statement made that Justice Gableman worked for crooks is literally true because Justice Gableman did, in fact, clerk for Justice Crooks. It's a true statement. Now, could one argue that it's misleading? Sure, one could argue that it's misleading. Either way, it is not a violation of the relevant provision that's at issue in this case, the mandatory portion of 60063C. But a final point, if I may, before concluding, Your Honor, is that, in fact, this ad was a television ad, and there were visual images that were part of the ad, which have not been discussed by the commission in this case. And, in fact, when there was reference to the underlying rape of an 11-year-old girl with learning disabilities, on the screen there was text that's referenced, 1984 CF 0250, the criminal case that statement referred to. And when the ad then referred to the subsequent molestation, Mitchell went on to molest again. There was a reference in the ad to a 1995 criminal case, 1995 CF 952148. That's information that's contained in the record. It's part of the actual visual advertisement that's at issue. Again, 11 years later, the reference is that Mitchell went on to molest again. Ultimately, the ad provides the underlying factual references that demonstrate to the viewer, not after the fact when we're arguing about whether this ad is true or not, but to the viewer has the references in the visual piece of the ad to determine what these statements relate to. And the viewer has the ability to conduct his or her own inquiry into the nature of the statements are made. And that's fundamentally a critical piece of all of this, which is this is a campaign ad, and it's for the electorate. It's for the voters of the people of the state who will vote for this office to determine the merits of the statements that are contained in this ad, the truth or falsity, whether they're well-founded, whether they're offended by the tone or not. But it's up to the electorate.
If this ad is not knowing misrepresentation of the qualifications, why was it so hard to put it on? Why did it take so long for a decision about it and to put it out? I mean, what is it that raises hackles?
Well, and I'll refer to the record, Your Honor, because the record states that Justice Gableman had concerns about the tone and wanted to consider that further.
What's the tone?
The tone of the ad, which he was concerned about the tone. But importantly, the tone of the ad has nothing to do with the underlying questions of whether or not there's an objective false statement contained in the ad. The record indicates that there was a delay, a week delay, before it was ultimately run. But the record indicates that it was because of a concern about the tone. And we're in the midst of a heated political campaign in which, again, the record reflects that Justice Gableman was being attacked for being soft on crime, for coddling child molesters, et cetera. And his political advisors were advising him to run a fairly hard-hitting ad. There is nothing against the law, nothing that violates this provision for a candidate, a judicial candidate, for running a hard-hitting ad. So to that extent, that's the answer, the reason for the delay, but ultimately doesn't implicate any issues, fundamental legal issues that are involved in this case, Your Honor.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. McLeod.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Alexander.
Thank you. First of all, let me say that when Mr. McLeod said that the commission agrees that the statements in the ad are true, no. As you all well know, we say the statement in the ad is false. What he's talking about are sentences. He never says sentences. He keeps saying statements. Statements are different than sentences.
So the statements are what's not said but what's implied.
No, the statement is the advertisement as a whole. All of the sentences, all of the words read in context and juxtaposition to each other.
Thank
not
you.
Individual
Thank
sentences. You talked about the Milkovich case, which he said was a defamation case, which it is. But when it was before the Supreme Court, and also you should know that it was a First Amendment case, the issue that was discussed wasn't defamation. The issue was the meaning of the language used. And it involved speech that concerned a public figure, so the standard that had to be proven was the statement had to be false and it had to be made with actual malice, the same as here. And you'll notice
you
both
agree,
the majority...
Do you agree, Counselor, that in a defamation case we look at what an objectively reasonable hearer of the statement would believe?
The language, and I'm going to read the language briefly from Justice Brennan in his dissent was, says, I also agree with the court that the statement that the plaintiff must prove false under HEPS is not invariably the literal phrase published, but rather what a reasonable reader would have understood the author to say. Now remember, this is a First Amendment case, and they're talking about First Amendment issues, and they're talking about how the court should go about determining the meaning of the language used. And both the majority and the dissent accept as a given predicate that a fact can be stated by implication and not doing any violence to speech that is protected by the First Amendment. So I think that the Milkovich case is, in fact, very important consideration for this court in determining what the meaning of the words are. The cases cited by Judge Gableman, the Buckley case, Wisconsin Right to Life, and they cite Republican Party of Minnesota versus White, they're all good law, and we agree with their holdings, but they're not this case. Those are void for vagueness cases in which the court was determining whether language passed by Congress was void for vagueness under the Constitution. Even Wisconsin Right to Life says that the language must be susceptible of no other reasonable interpretation. So we don't quibble with those cases. We just say that they are not this case, and that when you are looking at how to discern the meaning of words, it is more appropriate for this court to look at defamation cases, which deal with truth and falsity, and have universally said that language must be taken and interpreted in the context in which it is made.
Both of you look to the Washington case. Judge Fine looked to the Washington State case.
Riker,
yes. My question on that one would be, looking at Reichert, does Reichert protect all speech in a campaign, the majority there?
It would appear to do so, Chief Justice, and I must say the only thing I can say about Reichert it's that it's wrongly decided. It stands alone. And the only good thing about it is that it enabled the dissenting justices to give us a wonderful expression of the law that should be applied in this case on the First Amendment and what can be prohibited and what cannot be prohibited. But again, Reichert involved judicial interpretation of a statute. Not the case we have here. This is an advertisement that was published, a statement that was made by an individual, far more akin to defamation cases and how you determine the meaning of words and whether it is true or false. It's a much better analysis in the commission's opinion. We would also indicate that, once again, that this is the type of conduct that, if it's allowed to continue, it will be anything goes, and it will be a very, very slippery slope. Judicial campaigns will fall to the level of who is more clever and cunning and can lie without directly saying it, and therefore we're asking this court to censure that type of conduct. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Alexander. I want to thank both Mr. Alexander and Mr. McLeod for their excellent arguments and their briefs. We have a case that doesn't quite fit in other cases that that have been cited, and there's analogies on both, and a case that's very troublesome for the court and very troublesome for you all. It's very difficult to sit in judgment of anyone, and that's part of the judge's job, but it's especially difficult to sit in judgment when the person whom you're judging is someone you know and you work with and have worked with and will continue to work with regardless of the result in this case. And I appreciate the sensitivity of both of you in your appearance here and in your statements. And I know the difficulty for both of you in dealing with this. So on behalf of the court, I want to thank you both. That ends our hearing on 08-AP-2458J, Wisconsin Judicial Commission versus the Honorable Michael J. Holman. We are in recess. The court will meet in the conference room at 3:20, and we will have one final oral argument on April 28th, and in the interim, the court will also be meeting in administrative conferences. We are in recess.